I'm turning today to Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 9 and verse 19. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 19. For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more. And our subject is self-preparation for service, the service of the Lord. Now, the apostle has been speaking about the necessity that he feels, like a great burden upon him, to preach the gospel. He feels a debt to Christ, who saved him from condemnation. He was a persecutor, a slanderer. How can he ever repay the debt he cannot, that he owes to Christ for redeeming him and saving him? The gospel lifts from condemnation to glory. Of course he has a strong necessity and burden to proclaim it and preach it. Besides, he has a commission from God, a charge, a command, and he must honour that and fulfil it. And then he's pointed out, woe is unto him, a way of saying, alas, if I preach not the gospel. And there is woe and heartache to those who know the Lord and are saved by him, who have no place in the harvest of souls. How much they miss. Woe is unto them in that sense, at the very least. But it brings us to this 19th verse, for though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more. So first heading this morning is being all things to all men and women. Being all things. This is such a misunderstood expression. Free? Well, the Apostle Paul declares himself free. He repeats what he has said in verse 1 of the chapter. He's free from all. Our translators have inserted in italic there the word men to make make sense of the passage. But however, it's best read without the men, though I be free from all. The apostle isn't only thinking about people, he's thinking about, well, he's been pointing out, he's free, for instance, from the diet rules of the Jewish church of old, all the things that could not be eaten. He's free to eat whatever he chooses. Those laws are finished. They pointed forward. On the other hand, in his case, he chooses to abstain from some things so as not to offend the Jewish and the weaker conscience. And then they listen to him all the more freely. But nevertheless, he's free from those kind of rules. He's spoken about his being free to receive supports, subsistence, and so on from the churches. But also he lays that aside. So it's not just free from men, he is free from all things. And we just contemplate that for a few moments, hurriedly, before we pass on. Yes, he's free from obligation to all Jewish rites. The gospel has set him free from that. He's always been free from the worship of Gentile idols. He's not beholden or bound to the Gentile culture of polytheism and belonging to idol guilds and so on. He's free from all that entanglement. He's free from Roman slavery. He's a free man. He's free from any commitment to any particular philosophical school. And people bound themselves to these things. They followed a particular conspicuous teacher or philosopher, and many were bound to that teaching and to that person, And they had no intellectual freedom, really, to think outside that box. The apostle isn't bound by anything like that. In Christ, he's free. He's free from suspicion about being in it for the money and taking reward, because he never does. He works for a living. So in many, many respects, he can say he is free. And he says this in order that the contrast should be emphasized here in verse 10. Though I be free from all, yet have I made myself. This is a voluntary act. Servant, slave, literally, servant unto all, that I might gain the more. So he declares himself obligated to, indebted to all people. Now that's the attitude of the believer. Take a preacher. Somebody once asked me from the United States, who'd been following messages from here online, why is there never a word uttered which addresses the political situation? Well, that's not our business. Supposing we did intrude into this territory as preachers, supposing it were to be known that I supported this party or that party, or advocated this ideology or that political ideology, well then half the community would be much less inclined to listen to what is much more important, the gospel, the word of God. I would carry a label which they would disapprove of. So if I make myself the servant of all, I keep those things to myself. Unless we're talking on a moral matter, which would apply to all political shades of opinion, we don't declare who we are, what we support, what we would vote for. That's a private matter. And what are my qualifications for advising you on such things? Everybody must have their own view and come to their own conclusions. But in order to be a servant of all, for the much more important message, the message of Christ and the gospel, we subdue that. Any connection or support politically. The same with other things. Also, the minister and the preacher and the Christian witness should never be haughty, never be, in the old sense of the word, bookish. It's taken on rather a good sense now. The term bookish just means you're studious and diligent and interested and have a passion for books. Well, all that is maybe a good thing. But it used to have a somewhat negative sense years ago. Somebody who is bookish hasn't got any time for the ordinary, for the common sense, for plain speaking. He's up in another world and uses only five-syllable words, if he can, and so on. Well, that would immediately cut the preacher off from the generality of people. So if we're going to be all things to all men, we have to be very scrupulous and careful about that. It goes for all of us in Christian witness. Paul takes this view. He's a servant to all. Occasionally, you'll hear a preacher, maybe it's in the open air where the temptation is great, but you'll hear a preacher who's extremely aggressive and shrill with his proclamation, and that puts people off. Some people love it. It kind of stirs the blood if someone shouts at the top of his voice and is very shrill. But most people, it's the language of aggression, and they dislike it. So as soon as you adopt an extreme style, you cannot be a servant to all and commend your message to all. You have to be careful of these things. The apostle is very careful. And you have to consider, too, Yes, the ignorance of people, and explain things repeatedly and carefully. You have to bear with the slowness and the resistance to spiritual things which people have, which we all had before we were converted. We think back to our own years in unbelief and the stubbornness and the obduracy and the obstinacy that we displayed when people tried to talk to us or listening to anything spiritual. So we remember ourselves, and we have to have almost infinite patience with others and be inoffensive and courteous no matter what. So it's all part of this. For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all. And then the apostle says something really quite extraordinary. And weigh these words carefully. That I might gain the more. That's from the apostle Paul. That I might gain the more. Doesn't that produce a theological problem? Isn't the apostle Paul one of the grand teachers of the biblical doctrines of predestination and sovereign election? That I might gain the more? Is this consistent language? Do we or do we not believe in the predestinating love and power of God and the sovereign election of souls to life? Yes, we do. That's the clear teaching of the Bible. But yet, in spite of that, here is the apostle advancing this attitude of mind, that I might gain the more. You believe in sovereign election. At the same time, you work and you witness and you preach as though your message and your proclamation and your persuasion is going to make a difference. Your motivation is, if I can reach as many as possible. The two are wholly consistent. Salvation is in the hand of God, but we are set to make the general call of the gospel, the general offer or call of the gospel of Christ. You know, of course, that we divide the call of God, the offer of the gospel, between the general call and the effectual call. The effectual call is down to God. The general call is our responsibility. With full hearts, we reach as many as possible. Where'd you get that from? Somebody will say. Some Arminian preacher? No, I get it from the Apostle Paul. That's his attitude of mind, that I might gain the more. So we think deeply about that. And then the 20th verse, which these days is almost willfully misunderstood. And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law, the Jews, as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without law, verse 21, the Gentiles, well, I speak as without law. And then he qualifies that, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. What does he mean? Well, what he does not mean is that I conform my lifestyle, my manner of life, to that of most Jews at his time, in his day. He doesn't do that. Why? We're reading throughout the gospel about the hypocrisy of the scribes and the Pharisees, and of course the chief priests and so on. We read in the Gospels about their extreme sinfulness and their moral laxity, their utter hypocrisy. Would the Apostle Paul live like that? Would he too become a hypocrite in order that he could reach hypocrites? A sinner in order that he could reach sinners? Of course not. That is not his meaning. Unto the Jews I became as a Jew. Does it mean that he adopts Jewish rites and ceremonies, and that he urges fellow Christians to accept Jewish circumcision and the Jewish food laws and the Jewish sacrifices? Of course not. He says the opposite, and so strongly. If you get entangled up with that kind of thing again, he says to the Galatians, well, then you forfeit your doctrine of salvation, and you lose everything, and you make a nonsense of the gospel. You're no longer free. You go back to bondage. So he doesn't mean adopt Jewish sinful lifestyle or adopt Jewish rites and ceremonies. People think he does today. They don't read the passage properly. And they say, oh, if the world is all rock music and revealing dress and immodest attire and so on, and if the world is all cursing and swearing, we must do the same in order to commend ourselves to the world and in order to be heard. Well, that, of course, is absolutely against what the Apostle constantly and the whole of the New Testament constantly urges. So what does he mean? And before I explain, what does he mean when he makes the same point to the Gentiles? Verse 21, to them that are without law, who don't understand the Ten Commandments and the law of Moses, then I behave as someone without law. Does he mean he is lawless in Gentile company? Well, we explain then what he does mean, and I'll go on to talk about the weak. He means this, and he explains it. It's all about the law and being under the law. And it means this. When I'm preaching to Jews, he says, I take full advantage of the fact and I commend myself to their understanding by proving Christ out of the law and the prophets. They respect their scriptures. They respect the books of Moses, the law. They respect the prophets. Often the law is shorthand for the whole of the Old Testament in Paul's usage. They respect these things. If I can show them that Messiah is there, that they speak of Christ, that they prophesy him, that they describe his work, then the Jews will listen to me. I am not denigrating the old Jewish faith. It's vital. It was the preparation for the time of the gospel. I am using it and preaching through it. And that's what he means. Unto the Jews I became as a Jew. I used Jewish reasoning. I didn't follow the Jewish lifestyle. I used their reasoning and the things they respect, that I might gain the Jews, to them that are under the law. But then verse 21, to Gentiles, wasn't much good proving that in the books of Moses, in the Pentateuch, Christ is spoken of. They don't respect the books of Moses. They don't know them. They're ignorant of them. We'd have to set up a training course in the Old Testament scriptures before we could preach the gospel to Gentiles. They don't know any of that. Oh, but I can go to the law that's in their consciences, and I can counter idolatry and show the absurdity of it and show them the one true and living God and describe Christ and his salvation. So he's really describing here the different methods of approach he uses for Jews and to Gentiles, and we could prove that so very easily. If I turn for a moment to Acts chapter 28, and verse 21, you'll see this. Here is Paul at the end of his ministry, and he's in Rome, and the Jewish leaders come to him. Verse 21, "We neither received letters out of Judea concerning thee, neither any of the brethren that came showed or spake any harm of thee." I'd never heard of the hostility that the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem and in Judea had for Paul. But they said, verse 22, these are the Jewish leaders in Rome, "We desire to hear of thee what thou thinkest, for as concerning this sect, Christians, we know that everywhere it is spoken against." Now listen to this. "And when they had appointed him a day, there came many to him," he's a Jewish people, "to his lodging, to whom he expounded and testified the kingdom of God, persuading them concerning Jesus, both out of the law of Moses and out of the prophets, from morning till evening." There it is. And we could take you to other examples. In Acts 27, in Acts 17, Paul, speaking to Jews, proves Christ from the law and from the prophecies. And they listen and they respect that. And some believe the things which were spoken, and some believe not. But then, when he addressed Gentiles, such as, for example, at Mars Hill, the Areopagus in Athens, and he was addressing the Stoics and the Epicureans, Gentile philosophers, Greeks, what does he do? He doesn't come through the law and the prophets, because they didn't respect those things. They didn't believe them. He directs his preaching straight at idolatry, and he reasons courteously and shows them the absurdity of it. And then he preaches Christ to them and explains him and what he's done. But he doesn't go via the Old Testament scriptures. He goes directly to the conscience of the Gentile unbeliever. And he does exactly, we read about this in Romans 2 and verse 14. "For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law unto themselves." They have the law within themselves. So they don't understand the Ten Commandments. They've never read them. And the books of Moses. But they have a conscience. And the same moral standards are written by God in the human constitution, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another. So the apostle, back to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verses 20 to 21, is talking about the difference of his approach and his reasoning with Jews and Gentiles. This is not a license to conform our behavior, our music, our speech, our address to the lowest standards of the world. That's how the charismatics take it. They completely misinterpret the text. They take the punchline and they don't read the details. If they read the whole verses, they would see the error of their ways. But I'd like to refer to verse 22. "To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men," that is, I bear in mind their understanding and their reasoning and their use of language, and I carefully tailor my approach to what will be helpful and effective to them. I do not conform to their lifestyle or their ways. "I am made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Who are the weak? Now, this is a puzzle, because the Apostle Paul has not long since referred to the weak, and he's referred to converted people who nevertheless have a weak conscience, an over-scrupulous conscience. He referred to Christian people, converted people, who thought there must still be something in the idol. And so they were very offended at people who would eat meats consecrated to idols. Is he referring to them again? Christians with as yet unformed, complete views of the Christian life? I don't think he is, because now he's talking about winning souls. He's talking about unconverted people. So when he now uses the word weak, to the weak became I as weak, it would seem he's referring to a different class of weak person, not the converted person who hasn't learned very much yet, but the unconverted weak. Well, who would they be? Well, the Greek word translated weak here is literally feeble. The feeble. Could be the sick, but that wouldn't be all that relevant here. Could refer to the slaves, to the uneducated class of those days, meaning them no disrespect, whereas all men and women are the same, basically, and the same spread of intellectual ability goes through all the classes, no matter what people may think. But could it be slaves who had no access to any kind of education? Could it be children, or include children? Well, it could be any or all of these things. The feeble, the little ones, the uneducated, the disadvantaged. When I'm preaching to them, and there were many of them saved in those days. Some churches were composed of a majority of slaves in the churches of the Roman Empire. To the weak became I as weak. What does he mean? Well, he adapted to their vocabulary. Maybe he gave shorter addresses, particularly if there were lots of children. Used plain terms. Some preachers will even preach the gospel in 3- and 4-syllable theological terms, which outsiders and unchurched people would never understand. To the uneducated or the uninformed, well, you adapt. For children, you use many more illustrations, and you are never aggressive in presentation or style. It will alarm them. So that's what the apostle means. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men. So I just hope that clarifies these verses. It's to do with the presentation of the message, not the adoption of lifestyle. And verse 23, this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be partaker thereof with you. That really is a very beautiful sentiment, that verse. I do this for the sake of the prosperity and progress of the gospel. And then he adds, that I might be partaker thereof with you. The you is supplied by the translators. And it's the apostle's way of saying, I'm the same as you. You Corinthian Christians, you and I are under the same standard in this regard. You and I are both commanded of the Lord to adjust to our hearers and to use the necessary simplicity of language and plainness of speech and directness of approach to accommodate ourselves to Jews, Gentile reasoning, children, uneducated. You're under the same standard, so he beautifully adds, that I might be partaker of the gospel with you, same as you. Nothing different for the apostle or the preacher. The standard applies to us all. And that brings us down to verse 24 as we move to conclusion. Know ye not that they which run in a race run all? So a little bit here on the focused athlete and the lessons for the believer. Verse 24, know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run that ye may obtain. You run the Christian race as if you alone can win. In other words, take responsibility for your own service, as if you have to win this race. This is a rare text which in effect says, just for the moment, forget about your fellow believers. Focus on yourself. Are you running to win? Are you putting everything into your Christian life and service? Look at what the apostle goes on to say, verse 25. Every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate, self-controlled in all things. Self-control. So massive in the Christian life. Self-control. Watching our time. Keeping our devotions. Keeping up the concern for holiness of life. Self-examination, repentance, commitment to the Lord, restraint over things that would divert our attention and take us away from these duties. Every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they, the athletes, do it to obtain a corruptible, a perishable crown. But we an incorruptible, imperishable crown. The lengths, I need hardly tell you, to which those athletically gifted will go to outperform others. The things they will forego, the early rising and the practice. And they do it for something in those days, a wreath on the head that won't last. And we do it for an everlasting glory, freely and graciously given to us by God. We could never earn it, never earn even a fraction of it. It's all to be given to us in his great loving kindness, freely. And yet we won't make an effort, and we won't accept the disciplines, and we won't curb sinful tendencies. What reasoning this is, but we an incorruptible. Verse 26, I therefore so run, not as uncertainly. That translates a Greek compound that means unclearly. Uncertainly is a more acceptable word, but unclearly is the original. Uncertainly is perhaps broader. Unclearly, not seeing the destination, the finishing line. Would you run if you were an athlete? I was never an athlete. But we all understand these illustrations. Would we run if we couldn't clearly see where we were supposed to be heading? That's the Greek. I therefore run not unclearly. I keep the destination in view, and I run directly at it. A Christian life is all about destination. What's my destination? Well, in the short term, my destination is holiness and service and witness. Do you keep these things in view? Oh, you've got an invitation to go somewhere, do something. Do you keep your destination? How is this going to affect my destination? My service for the Lord, my commitments for Him, my personal devotions. How is it going to affect my Christian priorities and my Christian life? It may enhance them, good. It may wreck them. I didn't even think about it. I keep the destination in view. And of course you keep the ultimate destination in view. That great treasure, that eternal reward. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, without a name. The athlete, I believe, must work to maintain his stride, work to maintain his whole stance, the way he holds himself. He must run a tactical race, know when to conserve his energy and when to sprint. Has to know, have a strategy for his race. And so they did in those days. What's my life like? No strategy. All out expenditure of energy on recreational things. Exhausted for spiritual things. What sort of a race is that? You sprinted when you shouldn't have done. And you had nothing left when you needed the sprint. We can get it all the wrong way round. Lose the technique. Well, so much for the athlete. Just the closing points then, as we come to verse 26. And this is so helpful and interesting to us. The body as a serpent. I give you that as a final heading. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly. Halfway through verse 26, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air. Whatever does that mean? Most of the modern translations have decided that it refers to shadow boxing. Well, it may, but there's another possibility which actually is more likely. However, we'll deal with shadow boxing first. The boxer beats the air, certainly in shadow boxing. But there are problems with shadow boxing. It's not a real battle. It's all pretense. May do some good. It certainly looks good, because you're not up against opposition. You can shine shadow boxing. Anybody can. It looks good. You're not in any danger. The experts, this is probably not true, but for most, there's no power in it. There's no victory. There's no scoring. It's not achieving anything. So fight I, not as one that beateth the air. Well, that's a bad picture for the Christian life. Talk much, attend services, keep devotions, but not really fighting Satan. Not a blow is landing. temptations are uncontested. No witness. Talk well. Worship regularly. Keep devotions. No blows are landed. Satan lobs temptations in and you comply. That would be a fair Christian life described by the image of shadow boxing. But maybe it isn't shadow boxing. So fight I, not as one that beateth the air. I give you a more likely picture. That's a very similar one. This person is fighting. He's in the Isthmian Games, or the Corinthian Games, or the Games at Athens. And he's a boxer. The fight is on. There's no shadow boxing here. But still, he's beating the air. So it's a serious fight. But his punches never land. And you can see this. Well, I can remember years and years ago when all boys had to box unless they wore spectacles. And sometimes somebody would go into the fray furiously and punch very hard, but nothing landed. Not trying quite hard enough, not getting the length, nothing scoring, waste of time, getting hurt, probably rather good at it, looks very good, very impressive, but nothing is landing. That's more the picture. That's the picture so often of our Christian life. We're just not trying hard enough. Not much lands, not much score. It's half-hearted Christianity. So fight I not as one that beateth the air. But listen, now the Apostle Paul suddenly switches between verse 26 and verse 27, something remarkable happens. And he pivots round his illustration. This is very strange, but very significant. But I keep under my body. Now he's suddenly moved away from the boxer illustration, and he's talking about punching his own body. As for me, he says, I punch not my enemy, but my own body. What does he do that for? I keep under my body. I bring my body into slavery, into submission. Bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. I strike, I bruise, I knock out my own body, says the apostle. I knock out its rebellion. As for me, I'm fighting my old nature. I'm fighting my flesh. I'm fighting my body. I'm mortifying its sins and its tendencies. My body, the apostle seems to say, loves ease. I won't let it have ease. I'm going to work for the Lord. My body loves display. I knock it out so that I'm not driven by a love of display. My body wants indulgence. I knock it out so that it cannot be indulgent, self-indulgent. It wants satisfaction. It wants sensation. These are the things the body wants. It wants sometimes even uncleanness. It wants flattery. It wants attention. It wants pride, the old nature of the body. Now let's forget about boxers in a competition, the apostle says. We're fighting our own body. The body must be brought into submission. The old nature of the flesh, it must be brought into submission. It's here to serve your mind and your heart, your soul. That's the part of you that's supposed to be in charge. Picture this, your body always clamoring for attention, for indulgence, for flattery, for notice. Subdue it. KO it if you have to. Subdue it. Make it serve you. Make it be an obedient servant. That's all it is. Don't let it be the driver of your life and get its attention and its notice and its ease. What a picture. And how helpful. I keep under my own body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means it'll undo me if it can. When I have preached to others, even as an apostle, I myself should be a castaway. The Greek word means unapproved. Unapproved. And I close with this. It takes you all the way back to verse 24. Know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? And the others are unapproved, unaccepted. They lost. After preaching to others, I could lose out and be taken away from my ministry. And God will use someone else. He doesn't mean he'd be cast away from salvation. It's the same Greek word which in 2 Corinthians is three times translated as reprobate. If I don't submit my body and make it my servant rather than my ruler, it could be my undoing. It could bring me down into sin, and I will be laid aside from my ministry, and deservedly, no longer approved. So that's for all of us, dear friends. See the body as something that must be under control, so that your spirit, your mind, and your heart, and your will serves the Lord. That's our thinking for today.